Reed Walters, who is about to hold a news conference, Louisiana's governor said that the DA has decided not to appeal the decision sending defendant Michael Bell's case to juvenile court. Michael Bell, the one defendant, a part of the Gina 6. Looks like the DA is stepping up to the mic. Let's take it live.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I certainly appreciate that. But before I begin this conference, I would like to say that the people that you need to be applauding are these gentlemen you see standing around here being the law enforcement personnel of this area. Last Thursday, as you recall, was a pretty unique event in the history of the town of Gina. Many thousands of people were here. It had the potential, obviously, to be quite unnerving and quite disruptive. But because of the professionalism of the police agencies, and please forgive me if I start naming one, I'll forget one, so I'm not going to name anybody individually. I'm just going to say all of the law enforcement individuals who had a hand and a part in taking place in the demonstrations last Thursday, you gentlemen, you ladies, did an excellent job. You have my undying gratification. The people of the town of Gina salute you. I cannot tell you how extremely proud I am to be associated with you. Thank you. Now, ladies and gentlemen, again, thank you for your attendance at this conference. I want to again begin by reminding you, as I did in my first news conference, that there is a victim in this case. His name is Justin Barker. I want everyone to know that the decision I am about to announce is based upon what I believe is best for him. I have decided not to appeal the decision of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals that overturned the conviction of Michael Bell in adult court and sent the case back to juvenile court. This means the case against Michael Bell will now go forward in juvenile court. This decision comes after thoroughly reviewing the facts, been stressed by this. But let me say this, and I think this is a good time to say this and an appropriate time to conclude this conference because of the things that I have to get done. The only way, and let me stress that, the only way that I believe that me or this community has been able to endure the trauma that has been thrust upon us is through the prayers of the Christian people who have sent them up in this community.
One victim, Justin Barker. Yet, even though your little victimization of Michael Bell, trying him as an adult, and all the other shenanigans that you were doing and have done with the charges, that's not victimization. It just goes to figure, doesn't it, Reed? And then you babble out how the only way the community can overcome this trauma is through Christian prayers. A direct intervention of Jesus. Yeah, just like the direct intervention of Jesus who allowed the slaughter of the native aboriginals on the ground that you're standing on now, the direct intervention of Jesus to invade Iraq, Cuba, South America, enslave Africans. But none of us are victims to that onslaught because it's in the name of your God, your Jesus. It never ends. Another wretched Abraham. You know what time it is. Slave time. Check this. Radio.org, Santa Cruz with Skid, 104.1, 96.3, 106.7. Check out propagandapress.org, savagejustice.blogspot.com. Tune in to radioforall.net. Find out what time it is. Tonight, we're going into the ultimate race card game and how it's played out on Sam's plantation in the world. We got all that and a hell of a lot more on 103.3 Slave Revolt.
Seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
Make-believe world of the of American history, in this past and current living history, the noting of the victimizing of human beings for the greater cause of the American way of life is often ridiculed, scoffed at, and rewritten before one's eyes. With those true victims crushed under the boots of a supremacist order and ideology being told to get over it. Everyone in every group faces tough times, quote unquote. This dismissing of the others, quote unquote, plight is not only useful but necessary if one is to stay on and support the causes of a color-coded genocidal empire. It is also necessary that the true believers of this dead white and blue ideology turn reality upside down and backwards without not only appearing not to do so, but often not even realizing it themselves. So deep down the rabbit hole have the servants to their makers, in this white manifest destiny have willingly fallen. In this beyond the shadows piece called White Victimization, the ultimate race card, we'll search through and within this rabbit hole that's filled with lost souls. Now, whites often play the victims during their conquest of people like the Native Aboriginals. And during the Manifest Destiny period, which of course was tied to the conquest of Native Aboriginals and tied to the course of the empire, with its white subjects and their Abrahamic religion, in this case Christianity, all locked together in its deadly march. All three are supremacist constructs and components of not only the American character, but characters that you often see and constructs played out throughout the planet. The elite who tries to forge in market orders or empires is one of the supremacist constructs. Whiteness, of course, it can take on other forms of identities, like an Arab identity in the case of Sudan, and of course the Abrahamic religion. All three occupy a supremacist construct within this experience. White, while occupying the land of the Native Aboriginals, taking over their homeland by force, of course created a true homeland security survival resistance. Yet, this was looked at by the whites as them, the settlers, the occupiers, being victimized. Similar to the Palestinian-Israel situation. This victimizing of whites, quote-unquote, needed to be responded to with maximum genocidal action and methods on this containment reservation system, forced relocation, starvation, re-indoctrination, Americanization, Christianizing experiment. Now, similar aspects have played out with the white masses who have played victims in immigration issues, even though their white elite masters have created this situation through ramming through issues like NAFTA, GATT, IMF policies, World Bank programs. All of these have played an important role in the Latino immigration into the States. Yet, through the eyes of many whites, it's seen as Latinos victimizing them, occupying their land, creating more crime, taxes, as we've seen and gone over with O'Reilly and Geraldo Rivera on the drunk driving situation. Currently, there are loads of white vigilantes on the border to quote-unquote protect themselves from being victimized by the, how do they call it, Latino onslaught. Yet, while this farce is being played out for the whole world to see in classic white victimization lens, there's another aspect going on that somehow misses the radar. An article by Mike Davis called "The Perfect Swarm Head South" goes something like this. Quote, "The visitor crossing from Tijuana to San Diego these days is immediately slapped in the face by a huge billboard screaming, quote, stop the border invasion, unquote, sponsored by the rabidly anti-immigrant vigilante group, the Minutemen. The same truculent slogan reportedly insults the public at other border crossings in Arizona and Texas. The Minutemen, once caricatured in the press as gun-toting clowns, are now hotly celebrities of grassroots conservatism, dominating AM hate radio as well as even more hysterical ether of the right-wing blogosphere. In Heartland as well as in the border states, Republican candidates vie desperately for their endorsement, with the electorate alienated by the dual catastrophes of Baghdad and New Orleans. The brown peril has suddenly become the Republican mechanism for retaining control of Congress in the November election." So as you can see, all of these various elements are playing their various victimization and playing off of it for political attack. Continuing on, a faltering GOP hegemony too long sustained by the scraps of 9/11 and the imaginary weaponry of Saddam Hussein now has a new urgency in its appeal to the suburbs. Not since Kofi Annan conspired to send his black helicopters to terrorize Wyoming has such a clear and present danger threatened the Republic as the sinister army of would-be busboys and gardeners gathering at Rio Grande. To listen to some of these demagogues, one would assume that the Twin Towers had been blown up by the followers of the Virgin of Guadalupe, or that Spanish had recently been decreed the official language of Connecticut, having failed to scourge the world of evils by invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. Republicans, supported by some Democrats, now propose that we invade ourselves, sending the Marines and Green Berets along with the National Guard into the hostile deserts of California and New Mexico, where national sovereignty is supposed to be under siege. As in the past, nativism today is bigotry as surreal caricature. Reality stood on its head. The ultimate irony, however, is that there really is something that might be called a border invasion, quote-unquote, but the Minutemen's billboards are on the wrong side of the freeway. What few people, at least outside of Mexico, have bothered to notice is that while all the nannies, cooks, and maids have been heading north to tend the luxury lifestyles of irate Republicans, the gringo hordes have been rushing south to enjoy glorious budget retirements and affordable second homes under the Mexican sun. Yes, and former California Governors Pete Wilson's immortal words, they just keep coming, quote-unquote. Over the last decade, the U.S. Senate Department estimates that the number of Americans living in Mexico has soared from 200,000 to 1 million, or one quarter of all U.S. expatriates. Remittance from the United States to Mexico has risen dramatically from $9 billion to $14.5 billion in just 2 years. Though initially interpreted as representing a huge spike in illegal workers who send parts of their salaries across the border to family, it turns out to be mainly money sent by Americans to themselves in order to finance Mexican homes and retirements. Although some of them are certainly naturalized U.S. citizens returning to towns and villages of their birth after lifetimes of toil, the Director General of Fontour, the General Agency for Tourism, developed in Mexico, recently characterized a typical investor in that country's real estate as American, quote, baby boomers who have paid off in good part their initial mortgage and are coming into inheritance money, unquote. Indeed, according to the Wall Street Journal, the, quote, the land rush is occurring at the beginning of the demographic tidal wave, with more than 70 million American baby boomers expected to retire in the next two decades. Some experts predict a vast migration to warmer and cheaper climates. Often such buyers purchase a property 10 to 15 years before retirement, use it as a vacation home, and then eventually move there for most of the year. Developers increasingly are taking advantage of the trend, building gated communities, condominiums, and golf courses, unquote. The extraordinary rise in U.S. Sunbelt property values gives gringos immense economic leverage. Shrewd baby boomers are not simply feathering nests for eventual retirement, but also increasingly speculating in Mexican resort property, sending up property values to the detriment of the locals whose children are consequently driven into slums or forced to immigrate north, only increasing the invasion, quote-unquote, charges. As in Galway, Corsica, or, for that matter, Montana, the global secondhand boom is making life in beautiful natural settings unaffordable for their traditional residents. Some expatriates are experimenting with exotic places such as Riviera Maya in Yucatan or Tulum in Quintana Roo, but more prefer such well-established havens as San Miguel El Olinda and Puerto Vallarta. Here, these Noto Americanos make themselves at home in more ways than one. An English language paper in Puerto Vallarta, for instance, recently applauded the imminent arrival of a new shopping mall that will include Hooters, Burger King, Subway, Chili's, and Starbucks. Only Dunkin' Donuts, the paper complained, was still missing. The gringo's footprint is largest and brings the most significant geopolitical consequences to Baja California, the 1,000-mile-long desert apogee to the gridlocked state nation governed by Arnold Schwarzenegger. Indeed, Baja's real estate websites ooze almost as much hyperbole as those devoted to stalking the phantom menace of illegal immigrants, just in a far more upbeat tone when it comes to the question of immigrant invasion. In essence, Alta, Upper California, is beginning to overflow into Baja, an epochal process that, if unchecked, will produce intolerable social marginalization and ecological devastation in Mexico's last true frontier region. All the contradictions of post-industrial California, runaway land inflation in the coastal zones, sprawling suburban development in interior valleys and deserts, freeway congestion and lack of mass transit, and the astronomical growth of motorized recreation dictate the invasion of the gorgeous empty, quote-unquote, peninsula to the south. To use a term from a bad but not irrelevant past, Baja is Anglo-California's Lesbistrium. Let me stop right there for a second. So here you have a situation where, once again, while all of the victimization yapping is coming out of the behinds of, you know, these Minuteman type groups and sick politicians who, as administrators to these policies and to as administrators for the ruling order, know that they're helping to create these types of immigrations and exploitations of Latin people throughout the world, for that matter. The immigration policy that's taking place by the invading gringos into Mexico, stressing out the land, goes unnoticed and basically unchecked. As a matter of fact, is seen as something positive. As if the natives, once again, don't exist. Continuing. Indeed, the first two stages of informal annexation have already occurred. Under the banner of NAFTA, Southern California has exported hundreds of its sweatshops and toxic industries to the Makahuila zones of Tijuana and Mexicali. The Pacific Maritime Association, representing the coast, the West Coast major shipping companies, has joined forces with Korean and Japanese corporations to explore the construction of a vast new container port at Punta Colonial, 100 miles south of Tijuana, which would undercut the power of longshore unionism in San Pedro and San Francisco. So once again, you see how the issues of class, war, is tied to the color, indigenous rights, ecology, and autonomy, and how they're all being crushed under the new white manifest destiny that's tied to the capital market system. Yet, all one hears about is how white folks are being victimized by the Latino invasion. And when I say white folks, I'm basically talking about how it's basically coming primarily out of the mouths of white folks, and it's basically white folks dominating these borderline Minuteman, you know, games against Latinos. And even though they use the word America, we're stopping it against the invasion of America, they're looking at it through the eyes of white America, and quite typically, in classic American fashion, they think they can speak for everyone. Moving down on the article, it states that the next step in the late colonialization of Baja is the Escalera Nuata, a $3 billion ladder of marinas and coastal resorts being developed by Fontura, which will open up the pristine section of both Mexican coast to the yacht club sec. Meanwhile, the Truman Show has arrived in picturesque little city of Loreto, on the Gulf side of the peninsula. They state how there's 6,000 homes for expatriates in colonial Mexico's Montif on the Sea of Cortez. Let me stop right there. I think one gets the point. So once again, think about what you often hear about the Latino quote-unquote invasion, and put it into perspective of what was just broken down, and how the corporate media and others frame the issues, and also how they outline the topic and open up the topic of what you hear and what kind of invasions, quote unquote, you don't hear about. So, in part, what one starts to see is that this white victimization is in part based in denial. Denial of the history of exploitations and the contradictions that white folks often swim in within this market order. As this gringo invasion of Mexico outlines, it's also interesting that when whites leave America, it's clear they often want to bring quote-unquote America with them, the Starbuckification of wherever they go. When blacks leave the country, you know, to places like Brazil or the Caribbeans, that's the last thing black people have on their mind. Often it's the American way of life which is the sole reason why, or the core reason why, black people are leaving in the first place. So it helps dwell in how white victimization is often used as a catalyst for further exploitation, control, and domination, while at the same time whining how they're the victims, you know, of someone else. And being part of the victims is often tied to being part of the white man's burden, which is also a form of supremacy. You know, it's our burden because we're superior. You know, their victimization is based on their responsibility to uplift the dark races, the dark inferiors, or the land that they come from. Yet in the name of that obligation comes, well, slavery, genocide, occupation, Jim Crowism, colonialization, apartheid, imperialism, and on and on. Which, of course, ties into this catalyzation for exploitation, control, and domination. So in essence, white victimization is rooted in white supremacy. And we see this play on and on and on. Even when one looks at regional issues and white concerning, quote unquote, issues, like the Southern white version of the Civil War, historically and currently, that is tied to, the victimization card is played out. The Civil War was fought over states' rights. Even though it was the South that pushed the Fugitive Slave Act, which basically overrode states' rights in the North and in the West, that had laws against returning black people who had escaped from slavery to the North and West. Yet the Fugitive Slave Act, using the federal power of the government, overrode those states' rights, and you can go ahead and get that black person and bring them back to the South. In other words, white Southerners weren't for states' rights, they were for slavery. But they still, to this day, play this white victimization, states' rights game. Even when, as I pointed out, in Reconstruction's End, Black Bullets, White Bullets, how the conflict between the two white elite classes in the North, i.e. the industrial banking class, clashed over with the planter class, the bourbon class of the South, exploded. How, while it was an issue over slavery, it was not an issue over black emancipation or true black human rights. There's a difference. The white victimization saga continued into the Reconstruction period, where colored bullets met with the white terrorist bullets, as whites saw themselves victims of black rights. Rights like voting and political office holding, land ownership, and other basic issues that white America in the South was confronted with and detested, and looked upon as a form of, quote, Negro domination, unquote. As Lucas Lamar, a Mississippi congressman before the Civil War, a lawyer, a strong secessionist from the Union, a Confederate general, a slavery defender, part of the Bourbon elite class, after the Civil War, he became the first district U.S. congressman of Mississippi and remolded his image as a fusionist. Lamar, the anti-reconstructionist, gave a flowing tribute for Senator Sumner, who was a radical reconstructionist who had recently died. Lamar showered Sumner on his divine moralism and faked his respect towards Reconstruction and implied a need for North-South reconciliation. Yet, like the con men and women of today in America, Lamar's heart and sword laid elsewhere, as this letter by Lamar to Clark, written just before his April 27th, 1874 performance speech, reveals his true face, his white victimization supremacist worldview, as he starts off his tirade against Mississippi Republican Governor Ames.
You will find that his mission in Mississippi, as proclaimed by himself, is the exclusion, by means of the ballot in the hands of the freedmen, from any share in the government, of the only class in which reside the elements of dignity, virtue, and the welfare of society. A real effect of his scheme is that the white people of the state shall be for 4 years longer practically denied the privilege of self-government, their voice silenced, and their interests and their honor confided to strangers who neither comprehend the one nor believe in the existence of the other. I say strangers, for General Ames admitted in his speech here that his party of northern men and enfranchised Negroes were new to the political interests and institutions of the state. Draw a line on one side of which you see property, intelligence, virtue, religion, self-respect, enlightened public opinion, and exclusion from all political control. And on the other, the absolute unchecked political supremacy of brute numbers. And there you will behold not one attribute of free government, but the saddest and the blackest tyranny that ever cursed the earth. Let it be conceded, which I am always glad to do, that Ames and the men he carries into power are not corrupt personally. But it is impossible and certainly unprecedented for a body of men to be invested with such vast powers and irresponsible control over the entire wealth of a state without becoming corrupt and criminal. Where is the constituency to which these men will be responsible? Negro, it does seem to me that if there ever was a time when the white people of this state, the men in whose veins flows the blood of the ruling races of the world, should rise and with one unanimous voice protest against the domination about to be piled upon them, the present is that time. Can it be that the soul of our proud people, which a few years ago rose with such keen sense of wrong and heroic effort, has, by long oppression, been dulled into indifference and sullen despair?
So as you can hear from Ames himself, exclusion means the ballot being in the hands of freedmen, i.e. newly freed black folks and other black folks who could vote, who were not enslaved beforehand from the government. This exclusion from the government is the only class that resides dignity, virtue, welfare of the society. That only class for him equals white people. As then and now, an element of class and race coincide. Because whiteness is an elite construct. You can be a dead poor white person, but if you align yourself with the construct of whiteness, you are aligning yourself with an elite class construct. As Lamar continued, he talked about the dignity in virtuous class, meaning white folks, and how white folks are being victimized by the democratic process of voting by Mississippi's black majority in the form of their voices being silenced and their interests being confided to strangers. And how you have one group where property, religion, intelligence, self-respect, enlightenment, virtue stands and is being challenged by group numbers. And how this, not slavery, but this democratic voting process to Lamar equaled the saddest, blackest tyranny ever cursed the earth. White victimization. What constituency will the likes of Governor Ames be responsible to? Lamar says. Negroes. I.e. the inferiors. Not the group of intelligence and self-respect and virtue. As Lamar sums it up, talking about how white people whose blood flows, the ruling races of the world. So once again, you can see how white supremacy is tied to white victimization in a call of arms. White victimization is often a catalyst for white violence, white aggression, physically and economically. It's often a call for revenge. This is often in the face of the situation for so-called white victimization that was often caused by whites creating the violence and or the conditions in the first place to erupt. It also gets into the aspect of how white victimization is part of, once again, the element of white denial and a refusal to accept and understand the world as it really is. On a personal level and on a collective white level of how white privilege and denial is a key component to white victimization. Whites have played victims in the Vietnam War, even though it was the U.S. Empire who created and started the Vietnam War. They got little slogans like POWMIA, you know, mixing prisoner of war with missing in action. Yet, the powerful U.S. corporations were victimizing, just like they do in Iraq, anyone in their way, with Agent Orange, and in this current case, depleted uranium. But it's often not viewed that way by much of a disciplined populace. That the white elite created in the first place. This is the process of how these issues continue on. Yet while white victimization is very selective in its outrage, it's essentially a supremacist construct, just like whiteness is itself. Yet the average white person who's getting beat down on the plantation by the elite knows when to bark and bite and when to heal. In other words, just imagine if this event had happened because of colored terrorists attack on Sam's plantation.
Well, investigators are looking into that 2005 investigation. Both federal investigators as well as state and local are here on the scene as they continue to dig and look into why this happened. Meanwhile, recovery crews say for them it could be a while before they're able to safely remove all the victims.
A bridge in America just shouldn't fall down. And that's why we have called for this investigation.
The federal government is now leading the charge to try and find out why a Minneapolis interstate bridge suddenly collapsed. The structure crumbled without warning Wednesday evening, sending dozens of people and their cars tumbling into the Mississippi River. Rescue crews pulled some people from the water, but the raging Mississippi quickly turned too dangerous for divers.
We know of several people who were pinned or trapped, were at the time when we left them to D.C.
Investigators are examining the wreckage here with plans to eventually remove the pieces and reassemble it someplace else. They hope that may give them a clue as to why this happened. Meanwhile, the community is searching for their own answers. Hundreds of people turned out at two lunchtime prayer vigils looking for comfort.
Just whatever you can do to help, you know. And prayer is really all the families need right now.
Divers say that they really want to get back in the water, but at this point it's unsafe to do so. They're reversing the flow of the river, and they say once they lower the river about another foot or two, they may be able to get back in and remove the bodies of some of those people that they left behind. We're live in Minneapolis. I'm Brendan Simon. Michelle?
All right, Brendan, our thoughts are with you. I'm sure you guys are going to be dealing with this for a long time. Any idea how long the investigation is going to take?
Well, the NTSB says at this point their best guess would be 1 year before they're able to complete this. Meanwhile, though, they will begin building this sooner than that, but they're not even sure on a timeline when they could start to rebuild that.
All right, Brendan Conway, thank you.
Now, just imagine if this had been done by the various color-coded hocus-pocus groupings that are being pushed out as the ultimate threat currently in this global war on terrorism, which we all know is a scam. It would be night and day coverage since that bridge collapsed about the menace and how the war is not over. As the commentator stated, a bridge in America shouldn't just fall down. Then they stated how the federal government is investigating why the Minnesota bridge collapsed. This is all a sham. In 1990, the Minnesota Bridge was rated by the government of America as being structurally deficient. In 1990! There's well over 140,000 other bridges that are deficient. It would cost at least $190 billion to fix these bridges, according to the American Society of Civil Engineers. The public infrastructure of America is intentionally being abandoned, allowed to erode, decay, so it can be privatized. In Indiana, they have 157 toll roads. There's bills out to privatize like Chicago Skyway or lease it out. Now, once again, if this bridge had been blown up, the victimization card would have been played in full throttle. But since the masses are being victimized by an elite order that's intentionally not investing in the infrastructure within this society, whether we're talking the Levee system and the wetlands in New Orleans, or these bridges. The song remains the same. Yet, white victimization knows when to bark and bite, and once again, when to heal. An article by Ron Seester in the Christian Science Monitor on a Thursday, August 2nd, 2007, called Bridge Collapse Spotlights America's Deferred Maintenance. Talks about how one quarter of America's 577,000 bridges were rated deficient in 2004. That's 144,000 plus bridges rated deficient. The article goes, the tragic rush hour collapse in Minneapolis on the I-35W bridge over the Mississippi River is again forcing a reexamination of the nation's approach to maintaining and inspecting critical infrastructure. According to engineers, the nation is spending only about two-thirds as much as it should to keep dams, levees, highways, and bridges safe. The situation is more urgent now because many such structures were designed 40 to or 50 years ago, before Americans were driving weighty SUVs and truckers were lugging tandem loads. It all adds up to a poor grade. The American Society of Civil Engineers gave the nation a D in 2005. The latest report available after assessing 12 categories of infrastructure ranging from rails and roads to wastewater treatment and dams. One of America's great assets is its infrastructure, but if you don't invest, it deteriorates, says Patrick Natal, executive director of the ASCE. Among scores of recent examples, last month, a 100-year-old steam park erupted in Midtown Manhattan, killing one man and causing millions of dollars in lost business. The inadequacies of levees in New Orleans became horrifying clear in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina / Sam, of course. The city is still recovering. In 2003, the Silver Lake Dam in Michigan failed, causing $100 million in damage. Let me stop right there. So once again, though, since the victimization process is looked through in certain lens, in the American experiment, the response is also affected and infected by it. Another article, if people really want to get into the infrastructure and the privatization of this whole highway scam and beyond, is an article by Daniel Schumann and James Ridgway in the January and February 2007 Mother Jones a website called The Highwayman, The Privatization of Sam's Infrastructure by Destructive and Neglectful Design, basically. But then we can also take this legendary case of abuse and exploitation by the corporation called Enron and its victimizing of employees, biased employees, as one called a facility electrical power plant in Las Vegas and worked out a deal to have the Vegas power plant facility offline so that the people of California would have to pay extraordinary, deregulated, inflated electrical prices in 2001. Yet when these victimizers within these corporate structures are white and influential, this form of victimizing the populace looks and is framed much different on Sam's plantation.
Los Angeles Code Jim, this is Rich.
Hey, Rich, this is Bill up at Enron.
What's happening, Bill?
Not much, man. I'm giving you a call. We've got some issues for tomorrow.
Okay.
You ready for some issues? You're just about out of there, aren't you?
I got a couple more hours. I ain't going anywhere.
Good.
All right, shoot. I've got pen and paper.
All right, man. This is going to be a word-of-mouth kind of thing.
Okay.
Tonight, when you finish your normal QF, so for hour ending one,
right,
it'll be tomorrow.
Right.
We want you guys to get a little creative.
Okay.
And come up with a reason to go down.
Okay.
Anything you want to do over there? Anything like that?
Yeah. Yeah. There's some stuff that we could be doing tonight.
That's good.
You know, we need to come down and inspect this switch on the steam turbine. This one switch on this induction steam valve has been failing us, and we need to be down in order to pull the switch and adjust it. Yeah.
I like that.
And our electrician just happens to be on shift tonight, so it works out kind of good. Okay, so...
But we're not wanting to have it pre-scheduled.
Right.
It's supposed to be, kind of one of those things.
Okay, so we're just coming down for some maintenance, like a forced outage type thing.
Right.
And that's cool.
Hopefully.
Yeah, and whatever adjustment he makes today, tonight is probably not going to work, so we're probably going to have to check it tomorrow afternoon again.
I think that's a good plan, Rich.
All right.
I know I can count on you.
No problem. I'm sure I'll have a good time. All right, so I got you covered for tomorrow.
Thanks a lot, Rich.
All right, I won't even put that in the book. Okay.
Right on, man.
Bye.
Talk to you later.
Once again, one can see how the construct of victimization, especially for many white people, is tied to who's victimizing or not, which is why in part it's part of an elite construct whiteness is. In other words, when it's elites within the corporate world victimizing and neglecting the population, many whites don't see it as a form of victimization. Yet, when it's framed in other ways or other images, like the little Twin Towers, then suddenly it's a victimization that all are supposed to swallow. It also helps expose, at least this case, how, conspiracy, once again, like in many other cases, do take place. Sometimes pretty wide in the open. Yet another aspect of how white victimization in the race card is played out is when one gets caught ass out. There's this case, I checked out concerning this guy named Stewart who killed his wife and blamed it on some Negro in the mist. And the police actually had gotten someone's relative to say that, yeah, it was my uncle. Only it was later found out that it was actually Stewart himself who did the killing. Then he jumped off the bridge when he saw the shackles coming towards him. There's another case when a woman drives her kids into the water and blamed it on Negroes in the mist. Recently, Lindsay Lohan was recently caught driving drunk, and she told the cops that the black kid, quote unquote, was driving, in reference to one of the two males who were in the back seat, one white, one black. And then there's Bob Allen, who was Senator McCain's co-chair, who, when he was arrested for offering a black undercover cop $20 to perform a blowjob on him. Well,
a Florida lawmaker is launching an unusual defense in the wake of his recent arrest on a sex charge. CNN's Carol Costello joining us now. Carol, what is the state lawmaker saying about the events that led to his arrest?
Well, he said it was all because he was afraid of black men. This is a guy who touts himself as a family man, who co-sponsored a bill called the Lewd and Indecent Exposure Act, which would have made things like public sex illegal. Well, today, an explanation as to why he's charged with that very thing.
State Representative Bob Allen, the lawmaker voted Representative of the Year by a Florida Police Association, is now accused of offering $20 to perform a sex act on an undercover cop in a park bathroom. He's now telling Florida detectives it's all a huge misunderstanding.
This is something that, you know, this is my life on the line.
What you're hearing is Allen's taped police interrogation. He tells the officers he walked into that park bathroom not for sex, but because he was afraid of the undercover cop, who was black.
Chris Black, he's a black guy. There's none of those black guys around him. In the park, you know.
Later, Allen adds,
I'm about to be a statistic here.
Allen says he was so intimidated he would have said anything, including offering to pay sex with a stranger. A defense not exactly winning praise from civil rights attorney Richard Ugolo.
It's laughable. In this day and age, for somebody to suggest that they committed a crime because they saw a black person is just unbelievable and unimaginable. It's entirely racist, quite honestly.
And police aren't buying Allen's defense either, charging Allen with cruising for sex in Spaceview Park. According to their report, it was Allen who approached the undercover officer while he was inside of a bathroom stall and said, "This is kind of a public place, isn't it?" Then police say Allen proceeded to engage the officer in a conversation in which it was agreed he would pay me $20 in order to perform a sex act. Now, also according to this police report, as Allen was being loaded into the police car after his arrest, he said, "I don't suppose it would help if I said I was a state legislator, would it?" I guess the answer was no, Sue Don. I did call Allen's office for more comment today, and I have not heard back yet. Thank you, Kel.
So once again, we see a state Florida lawmaker who himself offered a bill to outlaw lewd, quote-unquote, and indecent exposure. Basically played the race card himself. And talk about how he's a victim of being misunderstood. Yet, he's the one who says that he was in fear of his own life. He sees a pretty stocky black guy and feels that I'm about to be a statistic. So he offers the black male he never met to have sex with. Now this is in the face of everyone in the world talking about how black people and black males especially are supposed to be so homophobic. Yet, this guy doesn't even hesitate to ask some black male to lick his penis. But once again, you see how race card is truly being played out in these last couple of cases I mentioned at the expense of black folks based off of stereotypes that so deeply reside against black people, while at the same time, it's the white people from the Stewart case to the Allen case who are playing victims themselves. And this is in a world where many people try to pretend that America has really moved beyond a lot of the racial issues. Then Allen pathetically starts going around speaking to black folks about the racist black male threat race car game that he dealt out, and has the nerve to think he can actually convince black people that his intent wasn't what it seemed to be.
Just the description can lead people to think, are you ducking into a class warfare, a race warfare scenario? Are you trying to pit the two together? Just because you were describing someone that way. If that sensitivity has been crossed, that was something I would definitely apologize for. That's how I described it. It was never meant racist.
So that's Allen still playing his white victim card and the race card and trying to convince black folks that he wasn't dealing the card against us. My statement was never meant to be racist. Once again, white denial is a key component of white victimization and supremacy. And also, it gets to the point where it's clear that many people just think we're fools. You can just say anything to us. Just go in front of the church and, you know, cry a little bit or whatever. Say it with so-called sincerity, with the right costume on, and all should be well. You know, get a pat on the head from, you know, some little jive time minister or whatever. And the game is supposed to basically be played out. Or scoffed at if blacks continue to insist that they don't buy it. Kind of like how Bill O'Reilly got his little feathers up in an uproar when black folks didn't buy his claim of how he characterized black people in a Harlem restaurant as not being racially coded in a negative way. But once again, denial is a key component. And this learned denial through white victimization is also based in a tactical, whether it's always conscious or not, is not really the primary issue. But it's a tactical game of deceit to oneself and the larger population as a whole that allows those trapped in the great American white illusion to boldly act out and play out double standards in life while claiming a level playing field is the ground that we stand on. The OJ case in white victimization versus the 200 plus black and Latinos who had to be released in LA from the Rampart Division Crash Unit LA frame-up is an example of that. While many people still hang on to the OJ case, other cases have exploded out in the lives of blacks and Latinos as the Rampart Division scandal explored after the OJ case, when one cop got caught stealing close to 8 pounds of cocaine, started squealing on himself and his friends to try to reduce his sentence. They started squealing on themselves, and the next thing you knew, you had a whole pig pen of cops squealing on each other, to the point where over 200 black and Latinos had to be released from prison who were framed up. Yet, it's still all about OJ. White supremacist cop organizations in LA have been exposed, like the Wayside Whiteys, the Cavemen, the Vikings. But somehow, it's still about the OJ case. White parents often pretend their kids are victims to black music and culture, while they, in their corporate boardrooms, make the largest profits off of black music and culture, just like their parents did before them. This is the way the scam in America is played. So as I've stated before, white victimization is rooted in white supremacy. And it's often easy for a supremacist to feel slighted by the inferiors, their culture, their identity, their very being. Which brings us to the Genesis 6 case. Another classic example of white victimization and race card playing. With many of the elements that I've laid out. In September of 2006, a black student asked the school administration, could he sit under what was known as the white tree? He was told that would be fine. You're a student here like everyone else, basically. But what has often been overlooked by this gesture is that here you had a black student go out of his way to try to avoid conflict by first asking authorities, white authorities, is it okay? Which right there tells you something is wrong. When a student feels that they are best for the interest and harmony and safety of one's own being and people, I better just go ahead and ask, basically, to this white administrator, is it okay? Which basically translates to, do you have our backs? If I and my friends go sit under there, do you have our backs? As adults, will you have our backs? And the administrator basically said, yeah, we'll have your back if you go sit under that tree and something erupts. So some students, black, sat under the tree. And then the tree nooses appear the next day. And as it played out, the administrator really didn't have their back. As the white superintendent said that the nooses were adolescents' play pranks, he stated, quote, I don't think it was a threat against anybody. And instead of expelling the white students who put the nooses on the tree, they simply gave them a 3-day suspension. When the black students protested, the district attorney, Reed Walters, rode in to town with some of his sheriffs, with some cops, armed police, and threatened who? The black students. As black sub teacher Michelle Rogers recalled herself.
The kids didn't say anything. They were listening. The kids were quiet. And so, you know, District Attorney Reed Walters, you know, proceeded to tell those kids that I could end your life with the stroke of a pen. And the kids were just, was like in awe that District, you know, Reed Walters would tell these kids that. He held the pen in his hand and told those kids that, see this pen in my hand, I could end your lives with the stroke of a pen.
So I can end your lives with a stroke of a pen. In response to the entire black student body protesting the events that unfolded, the nooses and the jive punishment, as they protested at the quote-unquote white tree. Reed Walters also said that it was an innocent prank himself. So once again, you see the denial. Two white adults acting like these are pranks. But Reed Walters goes further. I can be your best friend or your worst enemy. After his threat to the black students, the school was then put on lockdown for the remaining week. Then Thursday night on November 30th, 2006, a fire burned down the main academic building of Jena High. Friday, December 1st, a black student was beaten down by a group of white students at a quote-unquote white party. The next day, December 2nd, at a gotta-go convenience store, the black student who was beaten up the night before, along with a friend of his, ran into one of the white students who beat him. A confrontation broke out, and the white student went to his vehicle to get his shotgun. The black student wrestled the shotgun away from him, took it to the police department, and told the cops of the incident. What was the response of the cops? To arrest the black student for stealing the gun. The white student was not charged. A couple of days after that, on December 4th, 2006, a white student, Justin Barker, was attacked by a group of black students for taunting them with racial slurs and verbally supporting the nooses that were hung around the quote-unquote white tree. And also supporting the white students who beat up the black students at the party. He was treated at the hospital and released and later attended a social function later that evening. Six black students were arrested for beating Barker and charged with attempted second-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder. So that's when the Carwin Jones, Bryant Purvis, Michael Bell, Robert Bailey, all these, you know, and these guys were being, you know, like Carwin Jones was, Bell was set as 100,000, Purvis's was at 70, Robert Bailey, Bell was set at 138,000. And on and on. Reed Walters also stated to the DA that in a paper, in the paper, local paper, that when you are convicted, I will seek the maximum penalty allowed by law. So now, the issue of victimization ends up coming up in classic form only when Barker got beat down. But when the black students were being victimized and betrayed by the lack of human decency by white authority figures, that is not looked upon as victimizing the black people and setting up the situation for this to explode. So here you have a situation where white denial helped play a role in creating the quote-unquote white victimization scenario, where whites refuse to accept the truth that the nooses were real, that they were beyond a prank. They refuse to take any kind of real action based off of this denial against the students. The tensions keep growing, and they refuse to respond quite naturally, accordingly, in a humane way. And then, when the black students strike out, after one has been beaten down, knocked over the head with a bottle at a quote-unquote white party, after a few of them have a shotgun pulled on them, they're arrested. The white student pulling the gun is not. Then, only then, when a white student is physically manhandled, then the parameters of white victimization are set to play out in its extreme way. As I noted before, then white victimization becomes a catalyst for white violence and aggression, politically, physically, economically, a catalyst for revenge. Even though it was white people in that community that set up the conditions for this thing to get to where it was. And it was white adults who were the least responsible of anyone. But all of that is ignored. And law and order and quote-unquote justice must be served on the backs of black teenagers. Then, the administrators, the principals, all of them agree, now, this is something to expel someone about. You know, now they start expelling the black students, the J6, that is. Not over the nooses, because it was a prank, right? Then Michael Bell gets sentenced, convicted. Recently, he was let out and then put back in jail for violating his probation on another issue. The remaining 5 students await their charges of attempted second-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder. The white student who was beaten up at the convenience store, or who had his gun basically taken away from him, he was later arrested for bringing a hunting rifle loaded with 13 bullets onto a high school campus. He was released on $5,000 bond. The white students who hung the nooses in the quote-unquote white tree were never charged. So as white denial is a key component of white victimization, Billy Faller, a white member of the LaSalle Parish School Board, is just one of many white people who express this form of denial and victimization as he combines it with all powerful knowings and knowledge of how black people think and feel in general.
Our town is a typical Deep South town. If I could take you back 50 years ago, A lot of this that's been said today may be true. But if you compare us today to 50 years ago, we've come a long way. We're still not perfect, but we still are Deep South Southerners. I don't think you find anybody here that mistreats black folks. There's nothing in Gina that whites do that blacks can't do. Not one thing. If you'd have come during the week, I could have taken you up to the swimming pool where blacks and white mix swimming. We had a football game here a week ago. Blacks and white mixing without incident. Only a small portion of the black community here claims that we are racial. A big majority of the black folks will tell you they don't think it is. Unfortunately, the early stories that came out of the national media was inaccurate, and they only covered one side of the story.
So here you have this person talking about the big majority of black folks don't feel. I mean, this is classic when you get these types, you know, just talking for whole groups, you know. But that's part of the denial. Only a small minority thinks Jenna is racial. And then, in his mind, black folks and white folks watching football games together is indicative of some kind of harmony. Well, we all know that you can go to a basketball game, professional, college, or whatever, and see loads of black and white people cheering on the team and so on and so forth without, in, you know, overwhelmingly most cases, any kind of racial incident coming up. But that doesn't serve as a larger lens of how the racial component of America plays out. Right now you have loads of white folks in New Orleans cheering on the New Orleans Saints football team with star players like Reggie Bush being treated, you know, in elevated status. But that doesn't mean that they care for the 10-year-old Reggie Bushes who live and once lived in the Ninth Ward. It's just an illusion. But Billy Fowler continues in his white denial games by evoking next the FBI findings as if we don't have, as black people, an experience with the FBI on our own.
When the FBI report was made public, the FBI was in here days after all this took place, and they spent considerable time here, and they did a thorough investigation. They turned their investigation over to the U.S. Attorney for the Justice Department, who is Donald Washington, housed out of Lake Charles, Louisiana, and I happened to be at the forum when he gave the FBI report. And what he said in his report is that he could find nothing that was done wrong here in Gina by any authority. He couldn't find any law that had been violated in order to bring a charge against anybody. Now, he said that he felt like the DA's charges were harsh, but that it was within the scope of the law. It was to the fullest extent of the law. He didn't agree with it, and neither do most people around here today, both black and white, thinks the charges were too high. Even when you ask about the boys asking the principal if they could sit under the tree, well, these two sets, the white group and the black group, they were always throwing darts at one another in a joking manner. And that's what the FBI report said. It was in a joking manner. Bad taste. Bad taste. shouldn't have happened, but that's what was happening. Now, I know it's probably going through your mind, and this is the Deep South, and black people don't know the significance of a noose. Well, let me tell you something. The young black folks in the Deep South probably don't understand that. The older ones do, and they resent it, and I don't blame them. But the new ones, I'm not sure if they do or not.
The new ones. Well, do the new ones, meaning the new Jews, do they understand the significance of a swastika? I mean, this is just silly stuff. But, see, this is part of the denial game. You know, we're just supposed to just be out there drifting. Even though many of the students instantly knew what was going on with the nooses, which is why they protested. Now, this clown tries to pretend that everyone was just clowning around, sticking their heads through the nooses and all of that. You know, it's just like a big old game and stuff. Well, if that was the case, then why did the district attorney come with cops? If everyone was just having a good time, playing around, sticking their heads through these little tiny nooses, which basically means you have the head the size of an apple, why did the DA come? But they're so full of lies and denial and contempt to just address real issues as they really are, they just fall all over themselves in deceit. Now, talking about an FBI report, when, you know, I've done shows like the Sean Bell lynching, and I've gone over how the FBI itself out of Quantico, Virginia, has a diagnosis on black America. And when cases blow up, their diagnosis is basically to say, have governors, mayors, all of them come out and say they're going to do an investigation. You know, hopefully, you know, little fake Negroes like Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton will help, you know, cool down the black crowd and population by saying, wait, they're doing an investigation. I talked to the governor, so on and so forth. And what happens is that the fire for organizing and staying with the issue by the black masses will dissipate. And then another issue will come up, and then black people will be distracted like that, and nothing will get resolved. Now, this is the FBI's own analysis on black America, how to deal with these issues, not to resolve the issues, but basically to neutralize black development of coming to a solution with these issues. All one has to do is look at a lot of these reports at the FBI's own crime lab on top of that and know that it's all a sham. It's a scam. But this is what happens when you're deep in the white fantasy of denial and victimization, which is the ultimate race card. And as white fantasy and mythology takes to new heights, Fowler extends his white denial, white victimization game.
Only the parents involved of the six, you know, obviously they're going to be upset. But let me make another point here. When Mr. Washington went over the hate crime and told why the two white guys couldn't be charged, because blacks and whites were sticking their head through the noose in a joking manner. Well, after he went over those five components and said that the main component is there has to be intent to harm. Now, who do you think more fits a hate crime here than anybody? If you take what a hate crime, the five components, who more closely fits that than anybody? The six. It was a planned, it wasn't a fight, it was a planned deal. And there were people that got there to break it up pretty quick. The guy was laying on the ground unconscious. Now, as it turned out, he might not have been injured as severely as they first thought. He looked like he was dead laying on the ground because he was out. And they were still pounding on him when they got there to pull him off of him. So, was that intent to harm?
in my estimation it is, but you know what? Little old Gina being supposedly the most racist town in the world, nobody here has ever even suggested that. Nor do we want them charged with that. We think the charges were too stiff, too harsh, and I believe they're going to be reduced down. They did break the law, and they're going to be convicted of something, but it's going to be a lot lesser. Don't get me wrong. I've lived here. I spent 45 years in education before I retired in coaching. I don't see black or white. I see right and wrong. And I'm from the old school. I don't apologize for that, but I come from the old school, and I'm one of these that, you know, if I tell you I want something done, I want it done right now. I don't want to hear excuses. I want to get it done. So my outlook on this, I feel like they did wrong. There's some consequences to it, but not second-degree murder.
So once again, white denial and other things takes on new heights. Here you have a situation where he's talking about how it couldn't be a hate crime because black and white students were sticking their heads through nooses. Yet, there's no evidence of that even happening. And some little FBI clown claiming it happened doesn't mean anything. As if these guys are supposed to be taken for their word. He goes into this whole aspect about how they did break the law and they're going to be convicted. So he's already presuming to have the facts at hand. He talks about how who fits the crime, who fits, what situation fits the hate crime the most. And for him, it's the Genesis 6 issue, because it was planned out. It was a planned deal. According to who? Some DA who you're just taking his word for? Once again, this is a selective examination in mythology, especially with this issue about the black and white students were just playing, putting their head through the noose. Well, if they were all playing together, like I said before, then why did the DA and the cops come? If it was all just one big joke. But they're so deeply convicted into deceiving themselves and the public that this is what they spew out. Then he ties it up with this game of color blindness. I don't see black or white. I see right or wrong. Yet at the same time, these types of games have always been part of the American landscape. You know, Nixon, President Nixon, had a program in this war on crime, war on drugs back in his day. And Haldeman, an aide of Nixon, talked about how, according to Nixon, that the issue was supposed to evolve around the young, the poor, and the black. The young at the day were the hippies, the poor, and black folks were supposed to be the cause of all the problems. And Haldeman stated that, quote, President Nixon emphasized that the problem in this country is really the blacks, and the trick will be to blame them for everything without appearing to do so, unquote. So, in other words, all your social problems, economic, you know, white victimization is really the problem of blacks in the form of welfare, in the form of affirmative action. It's the Negro. It's the Negro. They're the ones causing all of your social ills. Now, to appear not to do so is to play a denial game that the elites are playing, and to expect a large majority of white people to also play into the denial game of white victimization, and then to respond back. in aggression, physically, economically, socially, in the form of the ultimate race card. But this is how the game is really played. So while they claim all of these issues, Howard Witt has an article September 25th, 2007 in the Chicago Tribune outlining how school discipline is tougher on African Americans, and in places like Minnesota, black students are suspended 6 times as often as whites. In Iowa, blacks make up 5% of the statewide public enrollment but account for 22% of the students who get suspended. And they go into all of the aspects of how for the same issues and infractions, the response is different in black and white. But here is the logic of white victimization and how it's articulated in this Genesis situation in all of its logic.
This is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance to Europeans and people of European descent, no matter where they may live around the world. Today I have an important program. Today the city of Jena, Louisiana is being besieged. It's being invaded by thousands of thugs demanding that a specific black criminal be let out of jail. He and his cohorts who committed a vicious hate crime against a white student in that city. The people of Jena, the people of Louisiana, and I are not racist. We simply want justice to be done. We understand that white people in America have lost our basic civil rights. Whites are now deprived of human rights by racial discrimination and jobs, promotions, scholarships, college admittance, and in many other programs. More importantly, whites are increasingly victims of black racial violence and hate crimes.
So once again, as you can see, this is the logic, and this is how it ends up playing itself out, where from the average, school administrator to a DA to a noted white supremacist like David Duke, they all sound the same, and all falling under the race card of white victimization, with denial being a key component, one of the key components. And how white victimization is essentially rooted in white supremacy. Essentially, they're saying we're the best, just like Lamar was saying in the 1800s. Look at what we white Americans have created, the greatest democracy on earth. And it's easy for these supremacists to feel slighted when the rest of the world doesn't bow down in their presence, internally or externally. Even the way that they frame some of the words when they go after other countries throughout the world has that element of supremacy. When you think about the terms like shock and awe, I mean, it's one thing to do a blitzkrieg on people, but it wasn't enough. Shock and awe. Basically, they are saying that not only are we going to shock the Iraqi people, i.e. traumatize them, but awe them in the presence of the great white folks' power of destruction. Denial takes roots in all forms in America. Even when a movie like Sicko helps expose that, no, this is not the greatest quote-unquote place on the earth. There's all kinds of demonic things going on even within the health system that just puts people out on the street when they no longer have enough dollars in their pockets to pay for their particular sickness, and have people choose between what finger they're going to save and what finger they're going to have to throw in the trash can if they don't have enough money. Many people still slither back into a form of denial and preach the same type of rhetoric that has been part of the fabric of their very being in this American experiment. So, from David Duke, who uses words that now Jenna is being besieged, this time by the black invaders, not the Latino ones. And once again, this all coincides with white people, the poor white people of Jenna being victimized. Of course, being in denial about all of the aspects that took place to create the situation to where teenagers acted out in the way that they did in the various conflicts helps expose just how deep and how lost much of this society is, which then ends up coinciding with, as I noted before, when white victimization feels threatened and challenged, whether it's by Native Americans for having the audacity to try to create some self-determination on their own land that's being stolen, or black folks in Jenna, or Iraqis in Iraq, the white backlash of violence is often heard in the air.
The website proudly displays a swastika on its homepage. Inside, one posting reveals the addresses of the Jenna 6, saying, quote, "In case anyone wants to deliver justice." The site is edited by a white supremacist whose own words can be heard in this streaming audio.
I'd like to go down there and put a bullet in each one of those little black kids that they've acquitted or they've let off on these convictions for beating this white child.
Asked if he brought any harm to the Jenna 6 with his postings, the editor told CNN, "I don't know that doing justice can be considered doing harm."
So once again, we see where the logic follows. As white victimization is often a catalyst for white violence and aggression, politically, economically, physically, for revenge. Even though the white race card that is often played helps set up the conditions to explode the situation in the first place. But since white denial is so deeply rooted in white victimization, this reality is often invisible. In 1873, the U.S. hit its greatest depression. Papers and people in general who were thrown into the depression and loss of jobs noted that it was the fault of the capitalists, the bankers, the railroad men. It was stated that way and acknowledged that way openly in America. But the response was basically to consume the rest of Indian territory in the Dakotas, to take over the Black Hills, to steal the gold in the Black Hills, even though it had been conceded the area to the Lakota Sioux. When the Lakota Sioux resisted and defeated George Armstrong Custer, white victimization once again showed its ugly head, which led to even more genocidal response from those playing the ultimate race card. Currently today, Philip Atkinson, August 20th, 2007, has an article called "Conquering the Drawbacks of Democracy." Some of it states like this: while democratic government is better than dictatorships and theocracy, it has its pitfalls. President George Bush is the 43rd president of the United States. He was sworn in for a second term on January 20th, 2005, after being chosen by the majority of citizens in America to be president. Yet in 2007, he is generally despised, with many citizens of Western civilization expressing contempt for his person and his policies, sentiments which now abound on the Internet. This rage at President Bush is an inevitable result of the system of government demanded by the people, which is democracy. The inadequacy of democracy ruled by the majority is undeniable, for it demands adopting ideas because they are popular, rather than because they are wise. This means that any man chosen to act as an agent of the people is placed in an envious position. If he commits folly because it is popular, then he will be held responsible for the inevitable result. If he refuses to commit folly, then he will be detested by most citizens because he is frustrating their demands. When faced with the possible threat that the Iraqis might be amassing terrible weapons that could be used to slay millions of citizens of Western civilization, President Bush took the only action prudence demanded, and the electorate followed. He conquered Iraq with an army. This dangerous and expensive act did destroy the Iraqi regime, but left an American army without any clear purpose in a hostile country and subject to attack. If the army merely returns to its home, then the threat is ended. It ended with simply return. The wisest course would have been for President Bush to use nuclear weapons to slaughter Iraqis until they complied with his demands, or until they were all dead. Then there would be little risk or expense, and no American army would be left exposed. But if he did this, his cowardly electorate would have instantly ended his term of office, if not his freedom or his life. Let me stop right there. I think you get the point. Here you have a situation where the imperialists expand for their own reasons, for their own goals, for their own detestable greed, in a genocidal mode into Iraq. And when faced with resistance from the mouths, from the behind of this Philip Atkinson, the G.I. Joes and Janes become victims. And in his own white manifest destiny worldview, that means that the course should have taken a more genocidal mode. Why be victimized, the imperialist claims? Why not just use ultimate weapons of genocidal mass proportion? This is a fool calling for the nuclearization of human beings on a broad scale. This is the logic of the imperial way of life. This is the logic of imperial way of life that's locked into the supremacist mold of white identity and how it plays itself out. From Jenna to David Duke, to the Family Security Foundation, which this clown is a member of, meaning Phil Atkinson. This is the logic of the ultimate race card that's tied to the elite order, an elite worldview. Kill, oppress, dominate at will. As I stated, white victimization is tied to white supremacy. And the construct of whiteness is an elite construct. And the people that are facing this world on Sam's plantation and giant global Indian reservations best wake up before that rabbit hole gets covered up permanently. Until the next time. Slave out.